We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
I'm talking today to Drew and Christine Vogel, husband and wife. Drew's the husband. Drew, he's a jiu-jitsu black belt, just to clarify, and my instructor. He was back on in episode 8 with Josh, and Christine is a newly crowned jiu-jitsu blue belt. But among other things, I'd like to talk to you today about your 10-day trip to Japan recently.
Yeah.
One of my favorite writers is David Sedaris. I'd like to read something he wrote. He's a funny dude.
I concur.
It's apparently, I don't know if it's true because I couldn't find this online, but it's frowned upon to smoke on city streets in Japan.
Right.
So he writes about moving to Japan for 3 months to quit smoking. Because that's like advice he got, is if you want to quit smoking, you should move. So he writes, in Paris, the cashiers sit rather than stand. They run your goods over a scanner, tally up the price, and then ask you for exact change. The story they give you is that there aren't enough euros to go around. Quote, the entire EU is short on coins. And I say, really? Because there are plenty of them in Germany. I've never asked for exact change in Spain or Holland or Italy. So I think the real problem lies in that the Parisian cashiers, who are, in a word, lazy. My reading skills suck. Here in Tokyo, so he's writing this from Tokyo. Here in Tokyo, they're not just hardworking, but almost violently cheerful. Down at the Peacock, the change flows like tap water. The women behind the registers bow to you. And I don't mean that they lower their heads a little, the way you might if passing someone on the street. The cashiers press their hands together and bend from the waist. Then yeah. They say what sounds to me like, we, the people of the store, worship you as we might a god. So, obviously,
that's accurate.
Obviously, that's a slight exaggeration, maybe, for comedic value, but how do you find the social interaction is different in Japan compared to Philly?
The bowing is definitely a very highly utilized skill set, and it's funny when you see two friends after a night of drinking, one of them will get on the train, and the other will always walk and accompany their buddy. And right before the train departs, they stand there just bowing to each other repeatedly. And even as the train is leaving, the person left on the platform continues to bow for another 20, 30 seconds after the train is gone.
Yeah.
So they do bow like at the waist?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Where are their hands? At the side? Or
hands
what's
by the sides.
Form?
Yeah.
Feet open slightly and head way down.
Did you get into the whole bowing thing?
Not quite as exaggerated. A little head tilt, which I do anyway.
Same with women, too? Or
yeah, the women, like, you'd go into the shops and everyone would greet you with a relatively elaborate, you know, introduction. It would be, we barely caught what they were saying, but it was definitely along the lines of, you know, good day, thank you for your business.
Yeah.
Please be assured that the service here will be of supreme quality, and please return.
Were you guys treated differently as foreigners?
I think in some areas, yes, in some areas, no.
Yeah. I mean, when they didn't want to talk to you, they would just walk. They're very determined people when they are going to do anything. So, you know, if they have no time or interest in you, they'll just whisk their hands at you. Like,
right.
It's just sort of like, oh, I'm sorry.
It's very neutral.
You know? Yeah. And then they'll walk straight past you.
Where did you guys go? Can you take me through your trip a little bit?
We started in, we stayed in an apartment through Airbnb, actually, in Roppongi, which is, I guess you could kind of say midtown Tokyo.
So started in Tokyo?
Yeah, started in Tokyo, stayed there for 2 nights, then went to Osaka, which is about an 8-hour bus ride southeast.
Yeah.
And then the last 2 nights back in Tokyo. So it was pretty much the equivalent to us hanging out in New York, spending most of our trip in, like, Florida, and then back to New York for 2 days.
Those are the two biggest cities in Japan?
It's Tokyo, Osaka, and then there's other smaller, you know, other equally important cities, but they're just not, they don't have the volume.
Well, those are the...
Those are the hubs.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, Tokyo, Osaka.
There's many cities within Tokyo, many cities within Osaka, right?
Like, the area that we were in, the Kansai region, which is Osaka and all of its outerlying, like, city-states, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
There, it's vast. It's just...
Prefectures.
Prefectures, exactly.
Right.
What the hell does that mean?
A prefecture. I guess that's it's like a mini city, I guess, because of the way that
I did see that term.
Virus.
I just kind of translated as suburb in my brain.
Pretty much, yeah. Okay. Yeah, it's like saying like you know, Upper Darby Prefecture, or you know,
exactly.
Yeah. So, Anthony Bourdain of No Reservations, he was comparing Tokyo and Osaka, and he said that Tokyo is seen as sophisticated and like reserved more, and then Osaka is more earthy and. And he uses these adjectives, which are very sophisticated, but Osaka is more earthy and direct. Like, people are more open, I guess.
Definitely.
Was that true?
Definitely.
Yeah.
I will say, though, like, just to go back a bit, that the Japanese are largely very polite, and they'll always try to make the time for you. There's a big misconception, I think, that they all speak English. They have a very basic understanding, just like we have a very basic understanding of Japanese. Like, if some Japanese person came over to us, we'd probably say, like, you know, konnichiwa, and that's what you would know. But that's sort of the equivalent there. Like in a lot of situations, we didn't have the benefit of, like, you know, bridging the linguistic gap, but people were really eager to help us, like, just point, like, you know, directionally. Like, if we knew the name of something, they would jump in and...
So they know hello and...
Yeah, they know, like, right, left, you know, hello, goodbye, welcome, thank you.
But, so is that politeness fake or is it real? Like, you know, in Philly, everyone is an asshole on the surface. Well, not true, but that's the perception.
Nah, that's pretty true.
But underneath, we're all very warm and welcoming people. So I keep telling myself. So is that politeness?
I don't know if it's fake or real, but it's not. It's impersonal. It's polite regardless of what you look like, what you sound like, where you come from.
I see.
It's just very across the board polite. It's almost like they do it for themselves more than they're doing it for you. It's
exactly.
A part of their personality, you know.
They would never serve you, for example, something that they themselves wouldn't be proud to present to you.
Right.
So that was really on the tip of our, you know, our experience was just how well things were handled physically and then how people would follow through socially. There was always a very clear and present structure of how things are going to go. And yeah, you'd say polite to a fault, really, because people I knocked heads with a lady in front of me. Like, I.
You headbutted.
She was apologizing.
Okay, first of all, I want to say that they have like the sidewalks and the streets don't have very clear divisions. Like, here, you know when you're going to go from sidewalk to the street. So I would always bump the lip of the tip of my shoe on like every little half inch lip that was between like one surface and another surface. They like having.
Surfaces.
Tiered surfaces there, which makes it very tricky to walk if you're trying to sightsee and like an asshole, you're looking up and you're not looking down.
Is there a thing where you like take your shoes off when it's a higher surface? I think I have to do that for a Japanese restaurant once.
Yeah.
Yeah, we did.
There's like very designated places where shoes always come off, like going inside a shrine, going inside a room where you're going to sit on the tatami mats and eat.
Right.
You know, going obviously inside on mats of any kind if you're going to train. Anytime you're inside someone's house, it's pretty much expected. Like, we would be like excommunicated right now.
Yeah. Well, you're literally on the tatami in this house.
We're very familiar at this point because we have the mats in our place now too. So we do try not to walk in the apartment with our shoes on.
I mean, my dream world would be where the whole place is just mats, like wall mats, and they could just break out and fight at any moment.
That'd be great.
It's a good drinking place. But he referred to Osaka's geography and history that it made it like the culinary heart of Japan is what he called it.
Yeah.
So you guys pig out a lot? Did you eat a lot?
Yeah. We ate a lot everywhere we went. I mean,
it was
like what you were saying, the
hearty.
Difference between Tokyo and Osaka is very real with the people. Like, the way that people greet you in Tokyo is very textbook. It's very like, you know, konbanwa, good evening, konnichiwa, good day, whatever. And it's very like by the book. Everyone pronounces it the same. Everyone expects you to greet them back the same way. But in Osaka, they almost kind of like giggle at you a little bit if you're that formal with them, you know?
Yeah.
It's kind of like going into balance and like calling Phil sensei. And you know what I mean? Like, he would kind of be like, no, just call me Phil, you know? Chill out. I think that was the impression I got from Osaka more than anything.
And really just to like to dial it back to like the journey, because you asked, you know, where we started and why, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm throwing
why
in the
why is the big question?
I had a very specific sort of idea in my head, because I'm originally from New York, and I thought, well, you know, I think about Philly a lot, how it's a city that most people really don't necessarily, you know, make the time for. Maybe it's just like a midway point between here and D.C., but it's a city that has a lot of character. And as a New Yorker, and now having lived in Philadelphia, I kind of was trying to think about Japan that way. Like, what is a place that I would like to get to know better? And I had lived with a girl from Osaka. I also knew another woman from the Osaka region, and I found them to be the warmest and the most genial at showing me how to cook. Like, they always were in the kitchen and always wanted to show me something or preparing me some kind of dish. And I think that was, like, my first real keen interest on my interaction with, you know, the Japanese was the Osakan people were of great interest to me. I think they were just, they seemed really down to earth, you know. And so I knew that Tokyo, like New York, can be a very vast, overwhelming place. And I thought, realistically, what do we want out of our experience? Like, do we want to just rush through a lot of different sites and centers of, you know, historical, cultural value, but like do it in a really hurried pace, or, you know, see what we can in the city and then venture into the heart of the country, where I thought people would be much more warm and inviting. So it was a very strategic decision to like to sandwich the trip, you know, with Tokyo and have Osaka be the main
good decision. But course. Like you said, I think one of you said before that 10 days was probably not enough.
No, absolutely not.
Not at all.
You gain time, lose time, and traveling is it's work.
It's a 15-hour time difference ahead there. So you figure when you get there, it's not hard, really. You get a good night's sleep. You wake up the next day, and you're pretty much on track. But when you come back here, I mean, up until 3 or 4 days ago, we were still feeling the jet lag after like a week and a half of being here.
I've been waking up earlier than I ever have in my entire Mexican life. I mean, I am not a testament to my people, because I love to, not those hardworking bicycling guys that go to the restaurant every morning. No, not. I've been waking up really early. I'm still not quite. I'm just finally getting back. And I think training really forced me, kind of kicked me back into
high gear. Gets you tired at the right time.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the funny thing is the pictures you took is, you know, you don't see the travel part of it. Mm. You don't see that, you know, those like animated dotted lines across the map as you get to travel. I guess that's a lot of the work. You mentioned that a part of you has always been in Japan.
Yeah.
I can only assume you mean the samurai. So can you try to articulate?
Just the really cool part.
Yeah, right. Why you think you're drawn to Japan?
I think as a teenager, I was surrounded by a lot of not only Japanese people, but very like Japanese centric people, just from training and, you know, friends of the family, everyone I knew had some connection to Japan. My instructor in Shotokan at the time was an old Japanese guy. His family would come to the US all the time and train us and talk to us about Japan and stuff. And I think I just always kind of like felt very at ease with that particular culture, the food, the people, you know, just the way of life. I think when I went, it really, like, a lot of people express the same sentiment that it feels very like you belong there, you know, like you feel like very at home, very at peace there. Yeah.
Was training, like, in the way you saw Japan and the value of why you wanted to go there, was just experiencing any of the training part of that, or did you just want to meet the people?
Yeah, I mean, the training, I think, is something that I want to, like, dedicate a separate trip to. Just because, you know, it's so varied and there's so much to do and, you know, so many places to see that I think this trip was more just like getting my feet wet and trying the food, you know, experiencing the culture, kind of seeing the sights a little bit. But next trip,
a little bit, right?
Yeah, we trained once in Osaka at Takahiro School.
We trained in a town called, it was near Ibaraki. I don't remember the name of the school precisely, but the training there was, I mean, as a person that wasn't raised in the martial arts at all, jiu-jitsu being my first martial art, you know, bushido. We were really amazed at the fact that they had really no focus on the combatives, like the self-defense aspect, but as white belts and blue belts, they had a very deep interest in a lot more of the current sport jujitsu style. So for me, just as an outsider, I was inundated with the thing about Japan that is so fascinating, which is always this constant parallel between like a tradition and a future. They're very much in that. Like they're very present. They totally have a grasp of their past and an interest in the future, like a zealous, like very hurried interest in the future. Like the trains are fast, the people are fast, the food is really, it's expanding. Like you just look at it and you go, well, I would never have thought of preparing something like that. But
it's like, all grounded in tradition.
It's grounded in tradition, but it's very sleek. It's very modern. It's very...
Yeah, so the portions are small. Don't people complain that it's very expensive, like relative to portion size?
I think
is that the experience you
in
had?
Tokyo more so, but yeah. it's very similar. I mean, I think any city is almost the same, where like you can get a decent lunch for, you know, a good amount of food for a decent amount of money. You know, a lot of the time it was like yakisoba, which is like a noodle and broth dish, or okonomiyaki. Is that
okonomiyaki,
which is like a kind of like a fried omelet,
it's
I guess you could say.
It's the same concept as an omelet. Like it was a way to really, you know, make more out of
less. Yeah,
less.
And then, you know,
and
buy
the takoyaki balls, the octopus balls. That's like leftovers. You use little bits of octopus and you make these round, like fried dough balls. They're almost like octopus donut holes.
Yeah, pretty much. But they're cheap. You can get that for like $3 or $4. You get a beer for another $1.50, and you know that's your lunch usually.
We were very lucky though. We really can't express enough gratitude to our hosts, Takahiro Kamasuna and.
So Takahiro, he was the guy, the smaller guy that was here and trained, right?
Yeah, he's the skinnier kid.
The skinnier one, yeah.
College student.
What rank is he at this
point? He's still a white belt. He's still a white belt. He's a four-star white belt.
He's very good.
Yeah, and he's gotten a lot better. Yeah,
when I first rolled with him as a white belt, I was like, this guy's sandbagging. He needs to get a blue belt.
That was a year ago, right?
But yeah, does he train still?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he trains often. His school is very good, actually. They're very Mendez-y as a school. They really like the Barambola leg drag, kind of spinning upside down style of jiu-jitsu. And they base all of their promotions on competition. So I think until Takahiro wins a competition, like a big competition, a white belt, he's not going to get a blue belt.
Oh, wow. That's so interesting.
Yeah,
that's
pretty sure that's the sole basis.
Yeah.
Like the school you trained at, was it a purely Brazilian jiu-jitsu school?
Yes. Yeah, purely sport jiu-jitsu.
Sport jiu-jitsu.
Yep. Zero striking, zero self-defense, like only sport jiu-jitsu.
Yeah.
Which really surprised me.
It is very surprising.
Yeah.
Especially because a lot of those guys have, or seem to have, judo background, so they're familiar with groundwork, but it's just not the same.
And just because of the culture, you would think like a strong martial culture would yield, you know. But
I wonder if that's true across the board. I would maybe that's an American thing or a Brazilian thing that spread to America, that it has to somehow apply to fighting.
Right.
Maybe the art itself is beautiful in itself, right?
I can't remember who I was listening to, but someone was talking about, you know, the difference just, I guess, on like a cultural level. When a fight breaks out in Brazil, it's very different than when a fight breaks out in the U.S. versus Japan versus anywhere else, right? In Brazil, when a fight breaks out, the tendency is to like circle around them and let them fight it out.
Right.
Yeah.
The tendency in the U.S. is to circle around them and then jump in. And then in Japan, there's just no street fights. The confrontations are at a minimum. So the self-defense is...
rates are like the lowest in the world.
Oh my God, yeah. There's
we didn't even hear them.
Virtually no crime.
You can't
even hear horns, yeah.
Like we hear the din of city traffic, but we can't quite make out why it's strange. Like we're out, it's busy. First of all, buildings are on average 40 to 50 stories high. So you're constantly craning your neck. But that aside, you're waiting for that cacophony of beeping and like cussing and just like rage that cities, you know.
Yeah, the New York rage.
Yeah,
it doesn't happen. Like people still bump into each other and people smash into each other in the subway cars, but it's like they don't even acknowledge it with their eyes. They just kind of like look right past it when it happens.
Yeah.
You know, it's nothing is really taken
angry.
Personally.
Yeah.
In the same way it's taken.
I think they're bottling up all that emotion. It's going to come out some other way.
The drinking
is the drinking.
The drinking and smoking.
Yeah. If there's any like I guess what we would consider like maladaptive quality of their lifestyle would definitely be the drinking at night with their bosses, which is, you know, a big part of the business culture there is like you go to your job at 9 a.m. or whatever, work till 6, and then you go out and drink with your boss until 8 or 9 or 10 or however long it takes.
But it's that assiduous work ethic that really pushes you. Like, it's not necessarily good. It's really challenging. Like, I think you have to not only have a long day of work, like they start their day and then they don't leave till like maybe 6 or 7. Because we would look in the building windows and we'd still see people inside after 5:30 working. And I was like, now they have to go continue their meeting at an izakaya, like a yatai, a little like food stand, get drunk with their bosses, laugh at their bosses' jokes. It gets a lot of pressure. Like,
I mean, even that's work for them, going drinking with the bosses, according to Takahiro. He's like, it's not fun. It's a very stressful thing because you have to be careful what you say, be careful what you do. You have to agree with everything your boss says. You have to, you know, be very diplomatic in your interaction.
Despite like 30, you know, pints
beers and sake and whiskey and rum. Yeah. They love whiskey.
They love tequila.
And the bowing.
Tequila? Yeah, it's apparently a new, it's a new trend.
And the other person you stayed with, so you talk about Takahiro, and you've also stayed with somebody else?
We stayed with Takahiro. He was the only one that we actually stayed with. He had a guest house in Osaka, but our friend Osuke, whose girlfriend Eri trains at Balance, he travels.
To train at Balance
he's been there a few times. He travels back and forth from Hong Kong. I'm sorry, from Tokyo to U.S. to California regularly.
And he said he listens to this podcast, so maybe he needs to be nice about it.
I think he does. Yeah.
That was the only thing he said to me. Your Lex. I like your podcast.
We were very fortunate, though. Osuke gave us a big hand in making our trip much easier to navigate. We didn't
took us
really
out to
understand
dinner the first two nights. Showed us the subway system. Put us up in a beautiful hotel the last night in Ginza.
I saw the view. It was beautiful.
It's incredible.
It was ridiculous.
Yeah, the first night that we were there, we met up with him at the hotel lobby. They dropped us off, and then we dropped off our bags into our capsule apartment because it literally was the bathroom was in the shower, like with the nozzle right in there. And the toilet was about this. It was the size of one of those moving boxes, Drew.
I know. I like the bathrooms though. Like there's no shower stall. It's just the bathroom is the shower.
And you close the door.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. So you just turn on a shower head, which is directly above, shower your whole body, like right where you would brush your teeth or whatever else.
Wow.
And that's how you get ready.
We were lucky because Osuke, we were traveling for at least 20 hours. And then Osuke's like, come on, we're going to go eat at near the Tsukiji fish market, which is where they auction off all those huge salmon. And
it's
was
the
like,
market you see on like Food Network all the time, like the big, you know.
Yeah. People wake up at 4 a.m. I mean, they have to be there at 4 a.m, but he brought us there really late at night and we were, you know, totally destroyed from being 20 hours on the road. And we get in there and it's not any place that you would readily pick out. Like it's just in a nondescript building. And as soon as we get in there, we're being fed live squirming sushi.
And so a lot of it was raw.
Yeah.
Everything. Yeah,
delicious.
And live, which is like
some of it was moving.
Raw.
Some of it was moving. Definitely.
Brushed with soy sauce and then squirming in your mouth.
Yeah. How was that?
Amazing.
Experience.
It was amazing. It's just, it's like an awesome
not for the thing that was squirming, but yeah,
the nerve endings were just, it was just an afterthought of death. It was like the memento mori and we were just boom right in our bellies.
Yeah, they do something different in the sushi there. Like I was talking to Osuke about it too and he can't really put his finger on what it is exactly.
Maybe the quality of the meat. I mean it's so
it's
fresh,
probably
right?
It's
some
right there. It's like
and
local
the way the rice is prepared and
the rice and the wasabi they were whipping. The chef in the back was chopping with a huge sharp knife and he was chopping the wasabi root so finely that he whipped it into a mousse.
Right.
He eventually whipped it with the knife like on the wooden surface. It was beautiful.
It was
and
fresh,
then,
yeah. You don't often get
the
it.
Sumo
yeah.
guy?
This was the first place.
Before. The sumo guy was the next night.
Yeah, sumo was the next. Chanko nabe. That was delicious too.
Yeah, you guys went to, you're right, you went, one of the chefs was a former sumo champ.
Yep.
Yeah.
And that, funny enough, is like the main martial art in Japan is sumo.
Yeah.
It doesn't spread across the world at all, but it is huge in Japan. Did you guys see that at all?
I
know you experienced that back in Philly. You went against the big guy.
Yeah. Drew had his debut with Biamba.
Yeah, that's cool.
He was delivered.
I didn't have my chance for a rematch, unfortunately.
There's a video of you going against this guy. Probably he's 150, 200 pounds more than you. I don't know what.
Yeah. He was 340. 340? According to the Russian guy, yeah.
I'm not sure.
He's big. Your stance looked good. You know, you got low. You're like, the form was good. I'm sure they were standing. Yeah. Did you guys see Jiro Dreams of Sushi?
Yes.
The documentary? So for people that don't know, it's... on the surface, it's a documentary about a chef who has been making sushi in a very simple way for, I don't know, 6-7 decades, something mm-hmm. like that. But
in the train station.
In a train station, yeah. And here's a quote. Once you decide on your occupation, you must immerse yourself in your work. You have to fall in love with your work. Never complain about your job. You must dedicate your life to mastering your skill. That's the secret of success. It's the key to being regarded honorably. Mm. So this kind of intimate connection to your work. That's the thing I get from Japan, is that people are like good at specializing in one little thing, and that's their job, and they get really damn good at it.
Yeah. People take a lot of pride in their work, and even jobs that we would consider menial are jobs that they're very happy to do and do well, and you know, wear a smile on their face while they do it. A lot of the employees at like the malls that we went to would bow in and out of the mall. Like if they had to go to the restroom or whatever, they would bow to the mall, go to the restroom, come back out, bow, go back to work. You know, it's very they honor their professions there. And it's funny what you say about not complaining about their job too, because we both found them to be very like they don't speak in terms of quality, in terms of like good and bad. And when you do, they don't really acknowledge it. Not that they like they're mean about it, but they don't think in terms of things being like qualitatively good or bad. They just think in terms of things being like as they are and just accepting that.
What you know? You mean like life, job, food?
Jobs, your station in life, you know. I think food is probably different. Like if the food is bad at a restaurant, they're going to be vocal about it.
Yeah.
So it's not part of the culture. That's part of the Philly culture, I guess, is to complain. Like if the Eagles are doing poorly, you complain about the Eagles.
Yeah, the Eagles suck.
You're saying they don't. They don't complain as much.
Yeah, they don't. They don't. They don't even acknowledge statements like that. Like even if it's something really good, they don't even talk about it in terms of being really good. They just, you know.
Yeah, they're not exceedingly one way or the other. But I think that there is something happening, and it's. I think the currents are shifting. I don't know if this is in large part due to the world economy, or just the fact that the internet is. It gives you access to just a greater deal of information, especially because the Japanese traditionally have, in the past, over 300 years ago, taken a very isolationist attitude. I think that's changed a lot now. Like, yeah. I think that there was a lot of movements, maybe even prior to when Japan was expanding its empire, its domain, Manchuria. Like, it was in a very progressive frame of mind, and then World War II kind of set them back a bit, and then they had a recession in the 70s that they still feel like they're recovering from. Like, it's very interesting to talk to younger people or people that are under 40, which was in our case, like most of the people that we interacted with, because they were the ones that spoke English. Mm. But they definitely seem more impacted by what's happening in their world. And they want to explore and they want to see other things. And I think I've had the experience that the Japanese women that I met, one of them was an artist, a potter from the Kansai region. She was living in Mexico with my dad's friend, who's an artist. Mm-hmm. And she was doing like an art internship, if you will. And then the other girl that I met, Nozomi, she also was visiting Hawaii in the U.S. just to see what life was like somewhere else. There's a lot of people now, I think, in Japan that go explore and bring back that experience, and they're impacting the way that the newer Japanese culture, like this whole attitude about perfection through repetition, I think that's changing
a
lot.
Old school.
I think it's old school, and I think most of the people that you meet that way, like even when I talked, I don't want to throw Osuke under the bus here, but I thought he said something very interesting. He was like, Jiro's place he doesn't really work there regularly. Like, you move up in the station.
Right?
So he's not altogether that impressed with it. He says, I've eaten at better places, but he says, that's because, you know, we regard, maybe I interpreted him as meaning that we regard the past in a certain way. It's very romantic. But I think in Oskay's mind that there's a lot to look forward to and there's a lot of exciting things happening. So he was really just eager to show us a ton of different things that were going on.
I think he also didn't like the fact that they told him how to eat his sushi when he sat down for the meal. And he's like, I paid a lot of money for this. Yeah. And they wanted him to eat it in a specific way.
They don't get to pick what you're eating.
No.
No.
It's his restaurant. You're visiting him.
Yeah, he picks what you're going to eat based on like your looks and the way, the shape of your mouth and things like that. I was like, okay. Your son is the guy that does most of the work.
Yes.
So that's part of, that's really the story of the movie is your, there's a man working in the shadow of his dad.
Mm. Yes.
And that relationship. Since you're speaking about, you know, women and exploring and
okay. This is
no, I'm not going there. No, don't worry, I'm not going where you think I'm going.
Exploring yourself and other female bodies.
There's a steep population decline in Japan. They're not getting married and not having babies. Mm. By the end of the 21st century, it's expected that the population will decrease by half. 50% of women aged 18 to 34 are single. 60% of men that same age are single. So there's a lot of single people.
Yeah, we definitely got that impression, like talking to our friends, because my friend Nozomi met up with us and then Takahiro was with us. And they have an age gap between them, Takahiro being younger and Nozomi being a little bit closer to my age. From talking to a young 20-ish guy to like a mid to late 20s woman, like, you get the impression that they're all looking and they can't find what they want and they're just not satisfied. So they're not going to settle.
Yeah.
They'd rather be doing their own thing.
Right. That's the sense I got to from just looking to a few interviews and stuff that people, they just have really high standards. They really like this. A few people just say they enjoy playing video games at home much more. And you find your little hobby that you enjoy. Like, for me, I can relate. You know, I have work that I love, and I have a hobby that I love, which is jiu-jitsu.
Yeah.
And when a girl comes into that, like, she's better be pretty damn good.
Right.
Because I have to give up a little bit of the jiu-jitsu and a little bit of the work. And so then the logic is like, well, why?
Yeah.
Because there's no, the pressure is decreasing on, you know, the only pressure I feel to to date is from my mom.
Yeah. To find out.
The old generations, you know.
To have babies.
To have babies.
Yeah.
That's right.
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't know if it's a good thing or a bad thing or, you know, I guess they would say it's neither, right?
Yeah, they would.
But yeah, I mean, it's a very prevailing attitude. I think like just the connection between men and women is very reserved there.
And the women do seem to get out more. Like the women seem to leave the country.
Yeah, they're very independent women.
They work too. I mean, they
work.
Yeah.
Much more equal.
Yeah.
When you trained, I saw a picture. Christine was the only woman there. Do women train?
Very rare.
I think there was one other woman there,
pretty rare.
She just didn't show up that day.
Yeah. Right. That's what they always say.
Yeah.
No, we have this other girl, I swear.
In the closet.
A women's team.
She's under the tatami mats at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just also that jiu-jitsu is still growing and, you know, it's really not the prevailing sport at all. I think in judo, you would probably find a lot of women.
Definitely. Right.
You know?
The school was small, so.
Even in sumo, there's more and more women these days competing.
Yeah,
which I didn't know either.
I had no idea until we left. Like, I was reading some literature that now there's women training.
So. Yeah. What do they wear?
I didn't get a straight answer on that. I was wondering the same thing. I can picture a giant singlet, but that's it, you know?
While Japan does have like one of the lowest homicide rates, there's amazingly just 2 gun-related homicides a year.
Yeah, it's very difficult to acquire a gun there. And Osuke was kind of breaking it down for us and giving us a little back history on the Yakuza. And he actually sort of reminded me of the Hell's Angels from New York, actually. More, they were there to sort of pick up the pieces after a lot of like the natural disasters occurred. A lot of them came in and helped
out. They were part of the tsunami relief.
Yeah, like people, like at different stages.
This is a very different view of the Yakuza that I
imagined. Yeah. I mean, I think you know, nowadays they're not perceived as, you know, I think it's still seen as a very like kind of dirty and scummy part of society. I don't think they're, you know, even now seen as like anything good or beneficial, but yeah, to a degree they were, you know, out for the community.
And people did change their attitudes, like at that time when they were mobilizing because the government was taking way too long. They were there to, right, you know, bring resources. People were, you know, had a very different attitude about them.
Yeah.
Did he say anything interesting besides that about the Yakuza? Was there any inside?
He said that there's one ghetto in Japan. I can't remember the name of it.
Yeah.
But there's only one little town that's like dangerous to walk around in. And you can
that's
see
where the gang warfare is.
Yeah, you can see the presence there. But he's like, you're not really going to see the Yakuza presence anywhere else.
Yeah, with two gun-related homicides per year.
Yeah. Not a lot of action.
But they do have one of the highest suicide rates in the world.
Mm.
If I was to be romantic about it, I guess it could be dating back to the samurai.
Sure.
Where
seppuku.
Yeah. So, I mean, it was honorable to commit suicide at the Lost Battle.
Yeah.
As I learned this from the Tom Cruise movie, The Samurai.
Of course.
Valid resource.
Tom Cruise, our great teacher and leader.
Very believable samurai, too.
I think he was the last samurai, wasn't he?
He was. Yeah, the last. He was. That's fact.
It's funny that the last samurai would be a white guy.
Scientologist.
Was he playing? Yeah, he was playing.
He
a
was
white
an
guy.
Amalgam of different characters. Okay. Apparently, he was sort of a cobbled up recreation of a figure that did exist at that time. But we actually, Drew and I have this penchant for kind of, you know, historical films, if you will.
Fodder.
fodder. we like movies like this. We're entertained by them. They definitely stoke your interest in, you know, the places that you already romanticize in your mind. So I think like when Drew and I watch The Last Samurai, we take away from it the beautiful scenery, the you know, Himeji Castle that you see where they do the shots of Ken Watanabe and him, you know, having their discussions. So things like that, like no one can really... Even though Tom Cruise is involved in that,
you always really, have to say that, right?
You have, like, it's still, there's something intrinsically balanced and harmonious about the Japanese aesthetic. You cannot get away from it. It's evident in even their most modern construction.
Mm.
We were in this part of the city. It was in Osaka, right? It was in that building. It was has a garden observatory, and it's at least, I don't know, 40, 50 stories high. And it's beautiful. And you go up there and you get these dramatic views, 360 degrees of the
Shinjuku.
City.
Shinjuku.
Well, it was in Shinjuku too, yeah. But you just get these views and you see, and it's almost, I think if you're a depressive type and if you're maybe there's something there, maybe
yeah,
they
it's like living by the ocean, right?
Yeah, maybe yeah. they like to live on the edge of that because they build these monuments, you know. And how do you as a human being, like, you stand there, and I was never described aptly the immense color vibrance of Tokyo. Like, it's many New Yorks over in one. I mean, there's 12 million people there. It's more similar for me, in my experience, to Mexico City's layout than it is remotely to New York. It is New York on top of itself, 20
and
times
out.
Over,
yeah.
And full of lights. It's Blade Runner in the middle of the day.
Yeah.
Is there any trees anywhere?
Yeah, there are. The landscape.
Yeah, there's not a whole lot of public parks just because of the space issue. But
they make the most of it, though.
A lot of the shrines have like a preserved wildlife, you know, like a natural sort of surrounding area that they try to keep as clean and up to par as possible.
Takahiro mentioned that you shared some words of wisdom with him. That confused the hell out of me. You said marriage is violence. No, what the hell is that about?
Man. It was part of a long conversation.
One of these, the conversation where at the end you bow as you depart on the train?
We both bowed furiously at each other.
We still are bowing.
And exited and saluted each other.
I mean, you guys, I guess what I'm trying to get to is, can you tell me the story of how you guys met? This is going way before Japan.
Alex is my sister. She's the mile marker, if you will. She's encapsulates the life of our relationship.
Yeah, she was just a baby when we met.
Yeah. She's in a narcoleptic sleeper.
Things have changed, obviously.
And now she's sleeping.
She was when we were in a deep womb.
You guys met in Philly, right?
We met in New Jersey, freshman year of high school, 2 years into when I was already training. And I think Christine at the time was doing fencing, right?
I didn't start fencing until after.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I was playing. I was doing tennis mostly, and
well, we met in study hall.
We did.
Yeah, and I think you talked to me first.
I did. Yeah. Drew was sitting with his. We were in a music room, so it was tiered. So they had the music stands, and he had his feet pointed, shot up straight in the air.
I had my legs resting on a chair before she gets.
He was sitting like a cartoon character with his feet above his head, and he had a sketchbook in his lap, and he was furiously just feverishly drawing. Yeah. And I wanted to see what he was drawing, I was on the lower level. So eventually, I kind of crept my way up the tiered seating, and I just said, oh, hey, how, I was really curious about what he was doing. He just seemed so. Drew had this deep, look about him. So I thought, well, swoon. I don't know.
Right.
I don't know. I don't know if I necessarily thought anything more of him other than I was intrigued by what he was doing because he seemed very focused. Mm-hmm. And everyone in our study hall was a 15-year-old reject. Were the sophomores that couldn't get into any of the classes.
Right.
So we were the freshmen in that group. And I was new. I had just moved from New York to New Jersey, and I was feeling still really displaced. I hadn't really figured out, where I fit into this whole thing. And
here's this beautiful kid drawing. What were you drawing?
What was I drawing?
What was your thing back? Did you?
Well, I was in a lot of art classes in freshman year of high school, so I was probably doing.
Was it people or no?
Yeah,
some people, some still lives. Nothing too. Too earth-shattering.
Well,
he was
drawing very quick caricatures of people, and his drawings were always amusing. They just had this sort of sarcastic sense of humor to them.
Yeah,
but that's really what drew me to Drew was his drawing. I was curious.
You guys hit it off right away, and
I mean, we didn't date right away or anything. We were just friends, freshman year.
Yeah.
And then she moved up to Rockaway.
Yeah, I moved up to Northern New
Jersey. And then we just maintained contact through letters and phone calls and emails and
We were pen pals,
AOL.
Basically. Yeah.
This is AOL?
AOL. Yeah.
I guess an AOL.com address.
Yeah.
But Drew and I mostly we wrote to each other. That was something that we both looked forward to was each other's letters in the mail.
Yeah, there's something about letters that you can't. I almost get annoyed with the immediacy of Facebook or any kind of messaging.
Yeah,
that is very. It's less romantic. It's less. I feel like when you write a letter, it's much more dramatic, and you're you talk about things in much grander ways.
And we did.
My love for you is endless.
We
the sea and the birds and the.
That was
we were
the
both reading The Fountainhead at the time, too, which didn't help anything.
Yeah, we were very moody little teenagers. Although we did have, we were very keen on each other. We were very curious. We still are. We still talk to each other in that way. What are you reading? What are you doing? Right. So.
So how did it change? How did you guys change individually and together through that time? And how does that lead up to marriage is violence?
There's always an end game with you.
That's a great question. How did we change? I don't know. How did you change, Christine?
I think, Drew and I actually lost touch. And it was, we had a silly disagreement. But being, very rigid and inflexible teenagers, we couldn't look past it. So we stopped talking for stupid reasons.
Premaritals.
Yeah, we were having our premaritals already. But we lived too far away. And we had a lot of things that were preoccupying us, and we just drifted away in a very natural, you're doing your thing and I have my own life up here, and it was just what it had to be. And we actually individually learned a lot on our paths before we reconnected. We had a lot of growing up that we just had to do on our own and individually,
basically ages 15 to 22.
Well, yeah. Drew and I Yeah, we hadn't. I didn't see Drew for like 5 to 7 years
right.
in that time, like physically see him. Like we would occasionally like run into each other in an email or.
By the time you saw me again, I was already a blue belt in jiu-jitsu. She saw me at a competition, my second ever competition she came to.
Oh, yeah. Well, you should preface it with how it happened.
Did you tell him you were coming?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, wait, no.
She just showed up.
Oh, it gets better.
Right. We were both seeing other people at the time, actually. And my then girlfriend was with me at the tournament as well. And your then boyfriend wasn't there for some reason.
But he was doing something. He was competing in the town adjacent to where I lived.
Was it? It was a Grappler's Quest.
Yeah.
Maybe
so,
in Wayne?
So
or?
No, it was in like Clifton or right near Clifton.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it was in the town right next to where I lived. Yeah. So when I reconnected with him, I don't know how it came to pass, but I found.
Oh, you emailed Josh.
I emailed Josh.
You found Josh in a chat room.
Yeah.
Of course, right. Where Josh lives.
Yeah. Not much has changed.
Yeah. I was really, it was like a crapshoot because really I didn't know how many Josh Wiggles were out there. So I was like, hi, you know, this is Christine. I was friends with your brother. If this is indeed Josh, please pass Drew along my information. And Josh emailed me back and goes, here's his number. Like, not even like, oh, excuse me. Like,
such a friendly guy.
Like, it's like you handle it.
He's like, here you go. Here's the number. If you're psychotic, oh, well. Yeah. Like, that's fun, Drew, not me anymore. But he was so great about it. Josh just was like, oh, here's his information. Call him right away. And so when I biked over to – I guess I will say Clifton because I think that's where it was.
Give but or take.
I bike over and I get there and I walk over and as soon as I see Josh, I know I've never met Josh in all the time that Drew and I were friends and we were seeing each other. Like, you know, it was you know, platonic love, if you will, right? Mm-hmm. It was crazy. I see Josh and I go, oh my God, that's his brother. And I have a little moment where I'm just like. Okay,
everything clicks into place.
I know. Yeah. I'm like, I'm here. This is real. He's at the weigh-in tables.
Right.
I walk up. I take my glasses off my face for a second because I can see near. And I didn't want to – like, I just wanted –
to look good for
No. I was just like – my eyesight was just sort of like – I didn't want to feel like I was staring at him so hard because I was really overwhelmed by how much he looked like Drew and Drew looked like him. I go to take my glass off and I crush them in my hand.
Oh, no.
And I act real cool about it. I'm like, oh,
no big
that
deal.
Just happened. Anyway, I was like, do you have tape? And I sit down. I'm sitting down and I have my head down and I'm in a gym. It's, of course, Naga High School Gymnasium. I know nothing of this world.
Yeah.
It's like a hot lunch in there. Yeah. Like,
and a romantic setting.
Drew walks over and I initially look up and I don't have my glasses on because I just demolished them in my hand, but I know that it's Drew and his neck is fat. And I'm like, what is going on here? Because when I knew Drew, his neck was skinnier than mine, like right now, today. Yeah. So I look at him and I'm like, he's an adult.
Yeah, grown up.
I hadn't seen Drew in that long. And so I was just in shock and happy to see an old friend.
Right.
And as soon as I was sitting cross-legged, he was walking up. I got up. I shot up. And, like, I just embraced him like I hadn't, you know, like
it's an old friend. Lion King where the little guy grows up and then they fall in love.
Simba?
Yeah.
Simba, yeah.
Yeah. Nala, the whole thing.
Oh, yeah, right.
And he grows up. Yep.
Cool.
It was pretty much that's about even.
Right.
Drew, would you like to finish the rest of the story?
Man, that
you're
was
all just nervous about competing. You're like, well, whatever this is.
He's like, I gotta put a fucking lid on this right now because I gotta compete.
Do this
man.
Later.
I think that was right before I went up.
It
and,
was.
I did okay that day. I took second, I think.
He medaled.
Yeah. And, I don't really remember much else about the day. I remember James Chirello, who's also been on this podcast, was there. He competed that day.
Katrina
my brother competed.
That was the first time I met Katrina.
Yep. His girlfriend Katrina was there. Or now wife, then girlfriend Katrina.
Then girlfriend.
It was a pretty chaotic and interesting experience in my life. Definitely a game-changing experience, if you will. It's funny when, like, you're kind of like going in one direction in your life, and then something from your past comes back and recenters you a little bit and redirects you back to...
Drags you back in.
No, but, it, you know, it kind of guides you back to where you were heading before you got carried away with shit, you know?
I think Drew was at like a cross point. He seemed to be very like focused on the jiu-jitsu, and like we'd never really addressed that we were in other relationships. We just talked to each other like we had just tried, we were trying to catch up, you know? So I knew right away that we both had a lot of things that we wanted to say to each other, but that weren't appropriate to like share and exchange over an email. Like we needed to have that FaceTime because so much time had passed. And look, when I saw Drew, I realized how far away I was going from what I wanted. And when I saw him competing, I didn't understand jiu-jitsu. I didn't really have a concept of it.
Oh, yeah. The first thing she said was, you should do Muay Thai.
I had no idea what it was. I thought, oh, maybe this is just some passing thing or something, you know? But I thought, well, it was really cool that he was doing it. And I thought in my own personal life that, you know, having not had that focus or drive for something that you're passionate about, I didn't recognize at that particular time in my life that I wasn't as fully engaged in what I was doing. And seeing Drew and Josh there, as immersed as they were, I was like,
yeah, really
okay,
passionate about this sport. Yeah,
yeah. It motivated me.
You're a blue belt?
Yeah, I was a blue belt at the time. Yeah, maybe like a 2-stripe blue belt. I was probably only like 2 years into it.
So that's like the peak of your obsession.
Yeah,
and you still think you're like the best ever.
Yep. You're going to be the world champion the next year.
I still feel like I...
Maybe a guy thing. Just an ego, giant ego thing.
A 20-year-old guy thing.
You have to compete with a lot more. There's a lot more people that have set the precedent for you. And I think with the women, it's like it's exciting for, you know, white belt women to meet blue belt women. Like I still get that excitement when I meet other...
Yeah, there's a bond that I'm really jealous of. Like when the Angie just set up an open mat, a balance... And I'm like, oh, they really like each other.
What's the matter with them?
Yeah. And eventually you guys decided to marry. Was that a step which most Japanese people failed to do? Tying it back.
Right, but, kind of you.
We one-upped them.
Yeah. Was that a tough decision? Just was it natural?
No.
Very natural. Very natural.
We were like, this is crazy. Like, we knew immediately and we were a little bit frightened. Like we were like, is this normal? Like, should we, like we wanted to just smash like, you know, like a atom fighting machine. Like I was just like, I asked Drew to come with me to California and we weren't even a boyfriend and girlfriend, if you will.
Right.
Like I was uncomfortable putting that category on us because I was like, we just met each other as adults. Like we don't. And then I was like, but Drew has to come with me to California. I was very conflicted. I was like, I don't know what's going on, but I know that this person I need in my life. And I couldn't have thought about going to California without having Drew with me. And I think
it's funny that there's this person that you can't really live without and you're uncomfortable putting a label of boyfriend on it. You hippies are funny with your labels.
It just feels in Russia, so ridiculous.
So I guess not much changed.
Yeah, I mean, jiu-jitsu came into my life. I guess that's the only thing that changed me. But I guess, you know, that wasn't that big a change. I was already training before that. So
I had envisioned Drew as a hippie, like drawing days away. That's pretty much
longer hair.
Long hair. He had curly.
Do you still draw?
Hacky sacking. No.
Oh, does Christine give you shit? Like, why
she draws
draw
more
anymore
than I do. She's better than I am now.
Yeah. I don't give a shit. I just like
photography
to leave.
Too.
Well, thank you. I you know what I do? I try to be very subliminal. I leave all the art stuff out for Drew so that if he ever has the inspiration, it's there.
No pressure.
I like Drew's drawings. It brings me back to a time. It's like when you read your favorite comic book and you're like, oh, yeah, I remember when I read that.
But speaking of atoms colliding, there's going into a dark area is one of the things when I mentioned like that you guys are going to Japan to other people.
Yeah,
the thing that always comes up is the Fukushima nuclear reactor and the earthquake and the tsunami That was, what is that, 2 years ago, two and a half years ago? Did that come up at all?
Yeah.
As a thing that, are people afraid of that?
I didn't get a sense of fear from it. Actually, people are surprisingly calm about it, I found. And
but they are disenfranchised with their government. Like, they don't think that their government has, I think they don't feel that the government entrusts them with information. So they do think that there's a certain amount of, or a lack thereof, of transparency.
And openness, right. That's why there's, if you go on YouTube, there's like a million videos, like conspiracy videos.
Yeah.
The government is hiding something.
Yeah.
Well, Takahiro told us that some of the higher ups, like the prime ministers of, you know, the all of the political head honchos left for a certain time, and they emigrated to Korea. Or like, you know, and then they would tell the people, oh, but it's safe.
It's safe to live there, but just not for us.
Yeah.
We're going to go live over here while this is going on. It's crazy that a lot of the older generations are the ones that stepped up to take care of the disaster though themselves. And kind of sparing the younger generations, you know?
And that's one of the interesting things about Japan. There's a lot of older people compared to other countries.
Yeah. Definitely a condition of their lifestyle, because they are very mobile, very ample. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, so there's over 50,000 people over age of 100 in Japan.
They live the longest, yet they kill themselves. Try to figure that one out.
Yeah.
For the next podcast.
Well, <it's, laughs> yeah, self-selection. Yep. But there's a few quick facts. See if any of them ring true to you. This is, for me personally, very emotional fact. Fruits are extremely expensive.
Fruit?
Yeah, fruit, like apples. And in some cases, 10 times more expensive than in the States. Like, they're considered a luxury item. I saw a musk melon, similar to cantaloupe, which costs like $5 to $10 here, is $300+ there. 31,000 yen.
There were a couple things that were more expensive. I saw avocados that were like $3 or $4 each, I think. But by and large, I didn't find that to be so. I think the fruit was pretty affordable.
And it's and like we said, the standards are so good. Like, you know, here you get a basket of strawberries and you're inspecting it because you suspect that the ones in the middle are going to suck. Well, when you go there and they give you
a basket of fruit, and
it's like $8 to $12 for a basket of strawberries, but it's going to be the best fucking strawberries you've ever eaten in your life.
What about, it says beer and wine is 2 to 4 times more expensive.
That's not accurate.
I'm glad you're breaking these myths.
It's definitely not true. And you can buy beer anywhere. You can buy beer in vending machines. There's vending machines all over Japan.
$2.50
In the most odd places in the world, like in cemeteries, there's vending machines. You can buy beer, you can buy soda, hot coffee.
Yeah, hot ginger ale, which I almost spat out through my nose.
That's weird.
It was delicious, like, though.
Like carbonated?
Carbonated hot ginger ale.
Carbonated ginger ale.
It's delicious.
Raw horse meat is a popular entree.
That's right.
It's called
horse sashimi. Wasashi.
Wasashi?
Yeah. Sliced thinly and eaten raw is called basashi.
Basashi.
Is that, did you guys try it?
We didn't try it.
It looked delicious.
I know. I did want to try it. I was a little put off by it, only because I like horses.
But I'm a Sagittarius, so.
But I like sashimi more.
My diet.
You hate
fucking fish.
Especially
vegetables. Squids. Just piss me off.
All right.
It's my spirit animal. I don't think I can eat that.
Horses? unicorns.
You know, Osaka and Ibaraki especially, they had horse sashimi, but I didn't
know.
You
know, we didn't hardly eat anything of beef. And you'd think, like, the wagyu and all the beef, but apparently even for the Japanese, that's a little too.
We tried some of the Kobe beef, though. We went to Kobe one day.
Yeah.
It was like
a croquette.
Yeah. Is that what it is?
It was like chipped Kobe beef in a deep fried delicious potato nugget.
Yeah.
Oh,
it was delicious. Actually cooked. So it was most of the stuff you guys ate was raw?
Mostly cooked. Mostly cooked, yeah.
Like, if we ate fish, it was mostly raw. But if we had, like, there, you have miso and tea with everything. And so even though you're eating what could potentially be radioactive salmon, at least it's getting detoxed with the tea.
Yeah.
That's their logic.
That's perfect logic. I like it.
Yeah, it is.
That the green tea.
They won't give it up.
The 98% of adoptions in Japan are of male adults. It's just a legal thing, I guess, so that the family business can remain within the family.
I talked a lot to Takahiro about the relationship of, like, not just the instructor to the student, but also there's what's called a kohai-senpai relationship, which is like an older, younger brother relationship between a lot of the athletes, martial artists, like everybody that has been training for a few years has a younger student that they kind of take under their wing and help along. So it's almost a natural kind of relationship for them.
There's a lot of respect for the higher.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah,
Is that different than in the States? Like if our instructor, like Phil, is very relaxed with the students, was it more formal?
The jiu-jitsu school we went to wasn't particularly formal. It was such a small school.
Right.
You definitely feel the familial nature, though.
Like, yeah.
There's something very... I think you get a sense of the character of the people. I don't want to say Japanese people because I think you can have this experience anywhere that you may travel. But like when you watch people interacting with each other, you can sort of see how their relationships are different than the relationships that we cultivate and foster here in the States. And there's definitely more of that tendency to observe those age, you know, differences. Like people do bow to each other and they do thank each other, and it's so much more on the, you know, on the surface, much more apparent than like here. Like you said, we might jokingly like, you know, slap Phil on the back or something like that, but that seems to happen slightly less there. But I think also they're also more inclined to like drink with each other too. Like we don't really go to the bar with Phil, but some people do. But like they
also impression that the jiu-jitsu schools there, especially, like they like that it's different than what they're used to. They like that it's different than a judo environment or a sumo environment, where you know it's obviously very formal, very you know respectful, very ritualistic. I think they like that it's like a more relaxed kind of thing. You slap hands and pound fists, and you know roll around with each other on the ground.
It's strange to have the culture that developed these fighting techniques have it be, you know, exported and then
imported again
because repackaged. For them, they perceive it as Brazilian jiu-jitsu. They don't hearken back to the traditions of like the judo, bushido, like and the techniques on the ground, like the newaza or the, you know, like that. In this country, we take it for granted that we're in the middle of that. Like we have the benefit of having the influence from Brazil, California, and from the East, and it all kind of merges on the East Coast. Yeah. It's very fascinating that way, at least from my limited experience now that I'm training, to hear all these different viewpoints kind of come to a head here. Yeah. Because right now, the way that the Japanese are practicing their Brazilian jiu-jitsu, I mean, it's really not attached to the traditions that they come from their own, you know, jujutsu, you know, like it's different. It's very different.
For anyone thinking of traveling to Japan, is there any words of advice, like mistakes or like best parts that you can say? One thing is 10 days is too short.
10 days is way too short. You have to have a friend to show you around. Don't try to find things on your own if you've never been there. Yeah, you're going to waste your time, and you're going to go to the worst, most touristy places if you do that. You know, it's like coming here and spending all of your time in New York in Times Square. It's not what you want to do, right?
Imagine being lost in Times Square for 10 days. And you don't speak English.
Yeah.
It's not the greatest experience. But it could be very fun, but I think when you have the luxury, like we were so lucky to have Osuke Takahiro and my friend Nozomi meet us, and they showed us their favorite spots.
Right. Which we never would have found.
No.
Everything is so tucked away. Like you'll find the best restaurants in the world that are like in the back of some corporate office building on the basement, you know, ground level floor or whatever, or, you know, underneath like an escalator leading up to a bank, you'll see like a sushi bar. It's like the most unexpected places that you would just like wander by, you know.
Definitely do yourself a favor and get yourself a very good
friend.
Well, yeah.
Make some friends.
Don't be a loser. No.
This is very tough.
No. You have to get yourself like a really comprehensive phrase book just so that you know how to interact in your most basic like everyday transactions, whether it's buying coffee, getting a meal, asking for a bill, because they really they go above and beyond when they do introductions with you, even if you're eating at a fast food place. Like, they'll say, hello, good morning, what can we do for you? What would you like? Have a lovely day.
They seem to really, a lot of people seem to really appreciate that we tried to speak Japanese with them too. We didn't just like point at things on a map or whatever. Like, we actually tried to learn the language a little bit, and they were very patient with us.
So it's not like France where they roll their eyes at the Americans?
No, not at all.
You know, it's true. Well, I'm soon heading off to training, so maybe it's a good place to end on a quote from Jiro. Do the same thing over and over, improving bit by bit. There's always a yearning to achieve more. I'll continue to climb, trying to reach the top, but no one knows where the top is. So, good words to leave on.
Very apt. Yeah. That's how we feel about our trip to Japan. We will return and we will conquer and vanquish all.
No. Yeah, training trip next time.
I mean training. We're gonna
Dojo Storm, National Dojo Storm.
All right, thanks for talking, guys.
Thanks for having us. That was cool. Thanks.